Right. Well, you guys, we are in this series. We've been in this series for about 250 years Matthew. And to tell you the truth, I love it. It's this incredible gospel, but we've been trying to cover it, and here we are, and we're in basically chapter 20, so we're getting there. But it's called Kingdom Design. And just a review. But I think the review is critically important in order to kind of understand the thread that God is trying to communicate. You know, you look at any biblical book, there is a thread of truth that ties all the pieces together. It's like a necklace. It's like a necklace of pearls. So the pearls are important, but the thread that runs between them is really critically important, right? To hold them together. And so that's the same thing in any of the books of the Bible. It's the same thing in the Gospel of Matthew. He has strung together the story, and the thread is important. What is that thread? Well, really, in Matthew, the thread is the kingdom of God. He has been trying to communicate the kingdom coming, the kingdom that is God's, and the what he is doing. So this kingdom idea, I think, is the thread of the entire thing. So let's look at here, kingdom design. This section of Matthew we've been calling kingdom design. And just let's remember, in chapter 18, it was the community of believers. What is the kingdom in the community? That among us, what's supposed to be true about the way we relate to each other, right? Okay, then in chapter 19 was all about the nuclear family. We spent a long time talking about what that nuclear family looked like, what marriage was about, divorce, adultery, all the different things we've messed it up with that we tried to communicate. So that was chapter 19, or at least the first 15 verses. And then chapter 19 through the end of 20, we've been calling is about kingdom design for the human heart. So it's taken it from the community to the family to the individual. And we've been trying to communicate that. The first one we covered that Brian spoke on was the rich young ruler who came and said, how do you get eternal life? And Jesus told him to obey the commandments. And he said, which ones? And Jesus laid out some. And he goes, I've done all of those. And he says, then why don't you take all your money and give it to him too? And he left in sorrow because he couldn't do it. And then there was the laborers in the vineyard, right? And some were hired at the beginning of the day, some at the ninth hour, some at other hours during it, and they all got paid the same. And it didn't sit well with Peter. He's like, whoa, what's that story all about? And Jesus is saying, hey, I need you to remember, Peter, that the first will be last, and that the last will be first. We're going to turn the world upside down on its value system. And then last week we talked about this mother's request, this mother kind of being a helicopter snowplow mom for James and John and saying, hey, Jesus, could you give my sons the preeminent spots in the kingdom? And Peter and Jesus says, hey, they're going to get spots, but you just need to know they're going to have to drink a cup that they don't really anticipate drinking. The cup always represents the wrath of God. The judgment of God. And he said, I'm going to drink that cup. And so you don't really know what you're asking, young lady. So, but then today we're going to talk about this. We're going to talk about the healing of two blind men. Okay? That's what it brings us to. Next week, in fact, in the beginning of chapter 21, right after this, is the triumphal entry. I don't know how it just kind of worked out that way. And next week is Palm Sunday, the triumphal entry. So just in the series, that's what we get to. Now, so here's this section, verses 29 to 34, of the healing of two blind men. Now, before we go jump into it, I want to ask this question. Why did Matthew choose this event, this story, at this point, where there were some very intensely important events he could have recorded, but he did not? It's not that he wasn't aware of them. He was aware of all these. During this last trip to Jerusalem, why did Matthew choose this one? I think it's a really interesting question. I've been wrestling with it for several weeks. And here, in fact, here are some of the choices he had. The story about Lazarus. So Lazarus had died. They asked Jesus to come and because he was sick, and he waited 2 days longer before he came. By the time he got there, Lazarus was dead. He'd been dead 4 days. Why didn't Matthew choose that story? Because eventually Jesus, some of the most incredible pieces of his ministry. It says that he wept. The only time that we know that he cried, it says he wept because of the pain of seeing Lazarus dying and his sister's pain. Matthew doesn't include it. He doesn't mention it. What about Zacchaeus? The story of Zacchaeus. So remember the kind of short dude that lived in Jericho? He was the head tax gatherer. He's making a ton of money, and Jesus is coming through town, and he has to crawl up in a tree just to get a view of Jesus, and Jesus looks at him and goes, "Hey, Zacchaeus, I'm coming to your house for dinner tonight." And he's like, "Oh my gosh, I better hurry and get home. You know, I've got to tell the cook." And I mean, it's this incredible story, and Zacchaeus says, "Hey, you know what? I'm going to repay everybody I ripped off. Everybody, I'm going to pay them, and I'm going to pay them back triple fold. I'm going to pay him back extra, all the people that I overcharge." He has this sign of repentance. Why does Matthew not tell that story? He doesn't tell it. Seems to me a really important one. He doesn't put it in his gospel. Or what about the parable of the minas? It's all about this stewardship of God's grace and God's riches and how you're going to use those. Why does Matthew not include it? I don't know for sure. It seems like those were really important. They were in the other gospels, or at least some of them. And you think, why doesn't he do that? Well, I think we're going to try to answer that question this morning, okay? So let's jump over to Matthew chapter 20, verses 29 to 30. Let me just read it, okay? "And as they went out of Jericho, a great crowd followed him." This is Jesus, okay? "And behold, there were two blind men sitting by the roadside. And when they heard that Jesus was passing by, they cried out." And just to, you know, I could just read it, but crying out. I mean, they're like crying out. This word crying means kind of loud. They're trying to get Jesus' attention. There's a whole crowd. There's a lot of people around. And so they're like, "Hey, we better raise our voice if we're going to be heard." So they're crying out, "Lord, have mercy on us, Son of David." And the crowd rebuked them and telling them to be silent. "Shh, stop being such a jerk. Be quiet. You're just blind men sitting by the road. You know, you're not important. You've been put to the side for a purpose. Shut up." You know, the guys closest to him were being the loudest. "Shh, be quiet." And so then they cried out all the more, louder, "Lord, have mercy on us, Son of David." And stopping, Jesus called them. And he said, "What do you want me to do for you?" And they said to him, "Lord, let our eyes be opened." And Jesus, in pity, touched their eyes, and immediately they recovered their sight and followed him. Now, I just want to read the story out of the Gospel of Mark. He records this. Now, Mark was not one of the disciples. Mark was probably not on the trip. He was not there. So who does Mark get his information from? Well, generally, on the most part, we believe that his relationship with Peter was probably where he got it from. Some people have even called this gospel the Gospel of Peter. We believe that Mark wrote it, but that he had interacted with Peter, who is this key individual, right? And so he has some more details to it, because Peter remembered these details in a way that he thought were important. Look at this in Mark chapter 10. It says, "And they came to Jericho, and as he was leaving Jericho with his disciples and a great crowd," now it names one of these guys, Bartimaeus. The blind beggar. Now, it only picks the one. Why does he only pick one? I don't know for sure, but maybe it's because of Peter's relationship. Because eventually, it says that they followed Jesus. Peter started to get to know this guy, probably over a period of time. And as he told Mark the story, he goes, "One of those beggars, I knew him. I got to know him. His name was Bartimaeus." Look at this. "And Bartimaeus, the son of Timaeus," he even knew his dad. That's awesome. "It was sitting by the roadside. And when they heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, they began to cry out and say, 'Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me.' And many rebuked him, telling him to be silent. And as he cried out all the more, 'Son of David, have mercy on me.' And Jesus stopped and he said, 'Call him, bring him over here.' And they called the blind man, saying to him, 'Take heart, get up, he's calling you.'" I mean, they're starting to feel bad, right? All of a sudden, like, "We told you to shut up, but Jesus wants you, so now we're on his side, and why don't you come over here?" You know, it's like they have a change of heart real quick. Like, "Oh, maybe you're not as big a, you know, knucklehead as you think, so get over here." And he's calling him, and he throws off, and I love this, and throwing off his cloak, He sprang up and came to Jesus. And Jesus said to him, "What do you want me to do for you?" And the blind man said to him, "Rabbi, let me recover my sight." And Jesus said to him, "Go your way. Your faith has made you well." And immediately he recovered his sight and followed him on the way. Wow. Well, let's go back to Matthew 20. It's kind of where we're going to hang out today. And let's just kind of grab on to all this stuff. And it says, as they went out of Jericho, a great crowd followed him. And behold, there were two blind men sitting by the roadside. And when they heard that Jesus was passing by, they cried out, "Lord, have mercy." Let's just stop there for a second. Let's put a heart behind it. Have mercy. It kind of has a feeling of heart, right? Mercy, compassion, all those kinds of things, a love. He has mercy. You know, here, the Greek word for this is eleo. There's two E's in the middle of it, so it's really eleo, but it feels weird to say that. So I'm just going to say eleo. The definition is this, because what they're asking for is to have pity on themselves. Have God, Lord, have pity on us. Have mercy on us. Show us that mercy. And this is the interesting thing. It is a word that describes that this mercy is as God defines it, not as we define it. It accords with his truth. It is a mercy that comes from him and defined by who he is and expresses God's covenant loyal mercy towards us, acting on his terms. It was interesting. I sat with someone this past week, and what they described to me was very interesting. They said, I base my life and my ministry on love. Sounds good, doesn't it? Yeah, it's on love. He says, and so then I open the scriptures and I find anything that describes the kind of love that I picture. And I grab onto that. I said, well, what about the things that don't sound like your picture of love? He goes, then I don't accept it. You see, he has placed himself in the center of the universe and to describe what love is all about. Whereas I would say we need to base our life on how God describes what love is rather than what I describe, because I could describe it any way I want to. And if the scriptures don't fit it, then I reject it. I cut it out. I take a razor blade and I cut that out of the scriptures. I don't like that. Throw it away. Rather than saying, here's what God describes as love. And I need my life to align with that. Because actually what he wants is the most beautiful expression of love. Not me. I could describe it in all sorts of twisted ways, which isn't what we've done in our world. It's exactly what we've done. So these guys are saying, Lord, have mercy based on your character, based on who you are, God. Have mercy on us. And then look at this. Not only that, and he says, have mercy on us, and then they define him. Son of David. Son of David. You guys, this is a title. This is a messianic title. Somehow these two blind men knew that he was the son of David. And let me just kind of put this up here. How could Jesus be the son of David when David lived almost 1,000 years before that? It's a fair question. But here's kind of the answer. The answer is that Christ, the Messiah, was the fulfillment of the prophecy that the seed of David in 2 Samuel, look at this, is what it says. It says that when your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, David, I will raise up your offspring after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom, and he shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. You know, it's interesting that Jesus, but into both genealogies of his adoptive father, Joseph, and in Mary, that David is in both of their genealogies. And the scriptures talk about the fact that he's going to raise up this kingdom. And it's going to come in David's line, and he says, I'm going to raise this person up, and this kingdom will be forever. So every time they refer to Jesus as the son of David, they're saying, you are the Messiah we've been looking for. You are him. And so these two guys that were sitting by the road somehow had come to the place where they were convinced that this man named Jesus was Lord, that this man named Jesus was the son of David, this man named Jesus was the Messiah. Is that incredible? You know, I wonder, how'd they know that? Well, my guess is this. They'd been hanging around Jericho for a long time. And when you're blind, what is the sense that you get really keen about your hearing. And they listened to everything said. For several years, as Jesus had been doing his ministry, he had been through Jericho several times. And there are people who are talking about who he is and what he's done and what he has said, and they have absorbed it. And these two guys became convinced that Jesus was Messiah. And then they were sitting there, and here they came. He came again with this huge crowd. And everybody would say, "It's Jesus, it's Jesus." And Zacchaeus is rambling into a tree. And people are trying to see what's going on. And they're like, "Oh my gosh, here he comes." And there's this huge crowd. And so they've got to, with a loud voice, say, "Jesus, have mercy on us, Son of David." Wow. They wanted to meet the one they knew to be Messiah. I love that. Look at this in verse 31. The crowd rebuked them, telling them to be quiet. Now, it doesn't say it was the disciples. The disciples were part of the crowd, but probably if it was the disciples telling them to shut up, it would have said that. You know, and so it's this crowd, these people who are following Jesus, and they're telling them to be quiet. Get behind, you know, like, get out of the way. You're a pain in the neck. You marginalized guys, you're not marginalized for nothing. Be marginalized. Sit over there and be quiet, please. But, I love this, but they cried out all the more. They got louder. We know people like that, don't you? You know, you tell them to be quiet, they get louder. I have a few in my life. They just get louder. Oh, you know what? Sometimes I can just be that kind of obnoxious person that gets louder. But they're like, "We're not going to be quiet. We know this to be the Messiah. I want to know him. I want to meet him. I want to tell him." And you know what? I love this next part. Look at this, verse 32. "And stopping, Jesus called them, and he said, 'What do you want me to do for you?'" Now, it's a really logical, great question. And on one level, we go, "Well, duh, isn't it obvious?" Well, you know, maybe not so much. You know, today, when there are people who are marginalized, handicapped, you see them. Di and I used to live in downtown Los Angeles. Not downtown, but in a very poor part, just off the edge of the University of Southern California. And when you walked to campus, you would usually get four or five times, every time you walked to campus, you got asked for money by somebody. And you had to figure out, what are we going to do with all that? And so we figured out a way that, you know, we were going to handle that. Because every day when you went to campus, every day when you came home. And we went to campus a lot of days every year. We were there for 11 years. So eventually you got to figure it out. And a lot of times people, it becomes very difficult to ask for money, right? It's what blind people would maybe do. So Jesus says, "What do you want?" And I love their response. This is incredible. "For they said to him, 'Lord, let our eyes be open.'" You see, why didn't they ask for money? Why didn't they ask for maybe some food? Why didn't they ask for maybe a new cart that they could walk behind to help them? If that's the way they do with blind people, instead of just leading them by the arm, sometimes they'd give them something to hold on to. Why didn't they ask for that? I think they asked for their sight because the only person who could meet their deepest need was Jesus. And they knew it. No one else could give them sight. The other people, all they could give is money or food or something else. They knew this is Messiah. This is the one who has healed others. We've heard about it. We believe it. We've heard all that he has said. All the people are talking about it. This is Messiah. And I'm sure, I would guess that there was a silence in the crowd. "We just want our sight." And Jesus, in pity, touched their eyes. You guys, this word pity, it's a different word. It's a Greek word, and I really like this word. You could maybe practice it at home. It's like one of those fun ones. Splag. You just go with splag, but then the ch, it's got this k to it in Greek. It's just kind of a k, so it's splag k, nidzo. Splag k, nidzo. I love that word. Just go home and practice it. You know, it's just kind of fun. Splagnidzo. But you're supposed to say it all together, so it kind of turns into splagnidzo. But it literally means this, that he felt for them deep down inside of him. In ancient world, the place of emotion, the place of love, the place was really your innards, kind of your gut-level thing. It means your heart, lungs, liver, kidneys. You know, sometimes when you feel it right in your kidneys, I know it doesn't, in America it doesn't work anymore, but you feel it right back here in your kidneys, or in your liver, and your lungs, and your heart. It is this reality of a rational compassion rather than just an empathetic compassion. You know, we live in a world that it's all about empathetic compassion. Doesn't really matter what's true or not true. What matters is what do you feel? And I feel it. But a lot of times in our world, I'm concerned today that our feelings don't actually drive us to behavior, to really answer the need. But a rational compassion understands the implications of the concern and the love and the pity and the mercy that I want to express. I think it through. How is it going to live out? What are the implications of this? We live in a world that's driven by our crazy emotions rather than a compassion that is deep set in who we are. And it drives us to respond. This is the kind of thing. So Jesus, in pity, in splagnidzo, touches their eyes. He meets their need. I love this. He touched them. None of the other Gospels record that Jesus touched them. I wonder if this is why Matthew includes it. Because he says, he touched their eyes, and immediately they recovered their sight, and they followed him. I find this story to be so powerful, and so profound, and so important, that maybe the story of Lazarus wasn't critical for what Matthew wanted to communicate. Maybe the story of Zacchaeus wasn't so important to him. And I think, why? So here's just a few thoughts. So therefore, what now? Here's just five thoughts, and then I want to answer the question, why? So here's some thoughts. I think in this story, we're reminded that Jesus' compassion and his authority defines who he is and how he relates to mankind. His compassion and his authority defines how he relates to each one of us, the same way he did to them. You see, he had compassion, but Jesus also had all authority, right? All authority had been given to him. He had all the authority in the universe. It defines how he deals with us. Second, the blind man's faith drove them to want to have an audience with the object of their faith, the person in their faith. They weren't satisfied with him just walking by. And man, I want him to touch me. He's the Messiah. They'd already decided. They'd come to faith already. And they said, Lord, I just want to see again. And he touches them. I love that. Third, the blind man knew that their deepest need was solely accessible for their deep soul. He knew that only Jesus could do it. He's the only one. Fourth, the other followers were actually a hindrance to their faith journey, right? To the marginalized. These other followers were a hindrance. And this part of the story really convicted me. How often am I a hindrance to those who seek the presence of Christ? Do I hold them back? Because these blind men were on the marginalized side of life. People believed, you know, if you're blind, you probably did something wrong. God, this is judgment. This is God's judgment on you. Stay over there. And Jesus said, that's not true. And we hinder people from coming. And Jesus says, man, bring them here. Bring them here. I want them. I'm going to touch them. Who in our world do we hold back from the gospel? Do we hold back from the kindness and the healing touch of Christ? You see, everyone's welcome to meet him on that road. Every person. No one gets expelled. They're all invited. We ought not to hold them back. and maybe fifth. The blind man's faith naturally translated into being a surrendered follower, right? It says that they were healed and they immediately followed Jesus. So my guess is they followed him to Bethany, where Lazarus was healed. I assume they followed him to Jerusalem next Sunday. I assume they watched what happened during that week. I assume that they were in Jerusalem the day that Jesus was crucified. Can you imagine what that'd be like to have the guy who had just healed you a couple of weeks before is now being crucified? They followed him. They followed him, I'm assuming, so Peter got to know them. He knew Bartimaeus. He spent time with Bartimaeus. They had dinner together. So tell me about your dad, Timaeus. Tell me about your life. What's it been like? What's it like to have Jesus heal you? They followed. Wow. So which one of those maybe is something you could grab onto? Say, hey, have I been an object? Have I been a hindrance to people? Do I need to really understand his authority and compassion in my life? Does it drive you to know him better and better and better? Is he the only one that can touch a certain place in your life that you want other people to solve, but they just can't do it? It's only Christ can do it. Does this idea of surrendering it all and following him? So let me just go to this. Why did Jesus, let's ask it again. Why did Matthew include this story at this point when all these other stories could have been told? Why did he choose this one? And here's my thought. It is in contrast to the self-serving struggle of these other stories that came just before it. Remember? We have the rich young man who couldn't abandon his wealth. He wouldn't give it up. He chose to hold on to it, and he left in sorrow. What about the disciples, especially Peter, who needed to learn that the first come last and the last come first? And Peter, sometimes it was a pretty self-serving dude. And Jesus keeps teaching him. Or what about that positioning and that posturing that was done by James and John and really by mom of trying to posture for them and position them? In contrast to that, it seems to me that we see in these two blind men a total dependency on Jesus. They made Jesus the issue. The centrality of Christ, the importance and priority of Jesus. When all these other guys were kind of caught up in so many other parts of life, and these blind men said, it is Jesus that I want. It is Jesus who I need. It is Christ. He is the one who through him and to him and for him, all things were created. He is the one who created the world. He will be the one who judges it. He is the Christ. And he came and he lived among us. And he healed these two guys. So my question is this. Is he worthy of your surrender? Is he worthy of mine? This Jesus, I think this is why Matthew put it here. It says, this Jesus is the one to whom you can surrender everything. That's his call. He is the one. He didn't choose all these other stories to tell. He told this one, two blind men, one named Bartimaeus. He says, man, I'm calling you. I want to touch you. I know you need that touch. I'd like to touch your eyes. You guys, where do you need to surrender? Is he worthy of your surrender? That's how we define this way back at the beginning of Matthew, of being a disciple, is a fully surrendered follower of a glorious Christ. He's calling us all to that again, to fully surrender our lives. Revelation, at the end of the Bible, it tells this incredible story. It's a book full of God's judgment and coming information about what's going to happen in the end of the world. But it's also about worship. In Revelation 4, verse 11, it says this, worthy are you, our Lord and God,
to receive glory and honor and power, for you created all things, and by your will they existed and were created. That includes you. That includes me. He created me for a purpose, that I might give him the honor and the glory and the power to surrender to him. So here's what I think it'd be good for us to do. As we approach next week and his triumphal entry into Jerusalem, that we would decide, like these blind men, to surrender it all. Surrender every piece of it. And there's probably things going on in your heart and mind even right now that you think, you know, I gave that to you, Lord, but I took it back. And I'm sorry I took it back. Lord, I know you called me to love, and sometimes I've decided not to. Lord, I've become my own master again, and I don't want to be, because I make a mess of things. So just to take a moment by yourself to say, is he worthy? Is he worthy for me to surrender to? So maybe just in the quietness of this room and in the privacy of where you sit by yourself, spend some time just thinking through, is he worthy of my whole life? Father, we are all blind men sitting by the road, pushed to the side, marginalized. And we've heard the message of who you are. And deep down inside, we've decided you are the Son of David. You are Messiah. And we all need a touch. A touch from you to touch the broken places of our lives. The sad, difficult, painful places of great failure, of the circumstances of life that have impacted us. And there's a great need that only you can fill, that only you can touch, only you can satisfy. Father, thank you for all the beautiful, wonderful things and people in our lives, but there are certain places in our soul that cannot be solved by any other human being, but only by you. Father, there's a reality to our desire that having been touched by you and to know you, that we would follow you. Just like these guys did. Just like Bartimaeus did. Father, I assume they probably messed up at times, and so do we. But Father, this morning we renew a surrender to you, to allow you to do what you want to do as we follow you. Father, touch us, though. Touch us in the places where we need to be touched. Our lives can be such a mess. Father, your love is defined by who you are. And we're really, at the end of the day, glad that it's defined by you and not by us. Because you are the one who deserves all the power, all the glory, all of it. And we worship you. Father, you are worthy. Jesus is worthy of our lives. So we give you our hearts today.